The Antrim, led by the Reverend Dr. Bert Tosh. Here we have a new book of the week. Chris Stewart reads from his memoir, Last Days of the Bus Club. 25 years ago, Chris and his wife Anna settled in the Alpujarras region of southern Spain, buying their own farm. Now their daughter Chloe is soon to leave home, and the times they are a-changing.
Through all the years of my daughter Chloe's schooling, it fell to me to get the family ship underway in the morning. I function better in the early hours. Anna, my wife, lasts longer into the night than I do. And so it was that on a cool September morning, the first day of Chloe's last year at school, I rose in the dark and, leaving my wife and the dogs fast asleep in the bedroom, padded across the cold stone floor to the bathroom, splashed my eyes with cold water, dressed and went into the kitchen. I put the kettle on, lit the candles for the breakfast table, and at 7 o'clock I woke Chloe. In all the 14 years of the school run, I did not have to wake her again on more than one or two occasions. She loved school, and would appear, without fail, 10 minutes later, blinking in the candlelight and clutching her heavily stacked backpack. Chloe's breakfast, a glass of freshly squeezed orange juice and a bowl of some absurd, industrially modified cereal product, was already on the table, while I busied myself with the first task of the day, the preparation of her mid-morning sandwich. In the creation of these little masterpieces, I employed all the imagination and artistry I possess. I couldn't bring myself to inflict upon my daughter the standard Spanish bocadillo, a dry and artless roll, unaccountably afforded the status of cultural icon, in spite of its curious quality of emerging from the oven almost completely stale. No, for Chloe's delectation, I would first select a better class of bun. These I would slit open with a razor-sharp knife, leaving an infinitesimal hinge of crust. Then I would oil them up with a little extra double virgin cold-pressed unfiltered olive oil from our own Picual trees. Add a layer of thinly sliced tomatoes, a dab of sugar to counteract the acidity, a couple of transparently thin slivers of fresh garlic, some Genoese basil, and finally a dollop of mayonnaise to help the whole concoction slip down. Oh, and a few chives sticking out of the end, like whiskers on a prawn. In truth, these snacks were not always greatly to Chloe's taste. When young, she disliked being marked out as different from her peers, and would mournfully report that she had shared her bocadillos with her friends, and the friends had not thought much of them. But gradually, things changed, and Chloe, charged with the nostalgia teenagers develop for their infancy, increasingly accepted my creations for what they were, simple manifestations of love. That morning, with an atmosphere of newness that comes with the first day back at school, the bocadillos crammed in amongst the books in Chloe's backpack and the backpack on my back, we left the house to walk down the hill and across the valley, with Bumble and Bow, the dogs, sniffing the fresh morning scents behind us. The first rays of sunshine were already warming the far side of the valley as we hastened upriver among the oleanders and tamarisk to our bridge, a ramshackle contrivance of worm-eaten eucalyptus beams thrown across the river. The bridge has no railings and tends to sag and creak if you creep gingerly across it. So we don't. Casting caution to the side, we leap down the bank and race across as fast as we can go. With only minutes to go now, we scrambled into the aged Land Rover and accelerated off along the sandy tracks in the riverbed and up the hill towards the final stop on a school bus route, just above La Cenicera, the farm where our Dutch neighbour Bernardo lives. Jesus, who keeps a flock of goats and sheep on the hill farm opposite us, was already there in his little white van, and Bernardo was leaning on its roof chatting to him through the open window. In a cloud of dust, we hurtled past the little gathering and raced to get the car turned round before the bus came. The dust had hardly settled before the bus nosed cautiously round the corner. There was a rush and tumble of frantic kissing as Bernardo kissed his son Sebastian, Jesus kissed his boys José and Javier, and I kissed Chloe, and they climbed onto the bus, leaving us three fathers waving until it disappeared round the corner. And so began the morning's meeting of the three fathers of the valley, Bernardo, Jesus and me, or the bus club, as I like to call it. I think we all rather cherished being able once again to have these few minutes together at the start of a weekday. We had missed it over the long summer months. It gave us a chance to discuss what was going on in the valley, exchange what scant news there was from the town, and reminisce a little. Turning to Jesus, I asked after Anna and Maria José, his two daughters. Not so long ago, they too had waited for this same bus, but a couple of years ago they'd left to go to university in Granada. It's always a pleasure to ask Jesus about his daughters, just to see the honest pride it stirs in him. The day that Anna and Maria José took their seats in the lecture halls of Granada University, one to study business administration, the other economics, was a giant step for their family in the valley, and it was felt by all of us. A generation earlier, it would have been almost impossible for country girls like these to attend university. They would have been needed to help on the farm, and a farm's meagre returns would certainly not have stretched to tuition fees and accommodation in the city. "Ay, Cristobal," Jesus said, "enjoy this year with Chloe while you can. It'll be gone in a flash, and she'll be off." Bernardo nodded knowingly. His two eldest were also living in Granada, while Rosa, his younger daughter, was about to leave to work for an NGO in Colombia. It seemed that the children of the valley were disappearing fast. Though Jesus still had the two boys and Bernardo his Sebastian, my days in the bus club were numbered. I changed the subject, a little abruptly. "I've got a lamb for you, Jesus, if you want it," I said. "It seems an odd time to be lambing." "I know, but we have a few out-of-season lammers, covered by a rogue ram. Anyway, one of them has twins, and I don't think she's got enough milk for both of them. Have you got goats milking at the moment?" "There's always goats to milk," said Jesus with resignation. "I'll be happy to take it." "Then I'll bring it to bus club tomorrow." And so saying, we all set off home to our respective breakfasts. It was not many weeks after the beginning of the term that I got a call from Chloe's school. It was from the assistant head, no less, and she wondered if, as a local author, accustomed to regaling the public on the subject of my books, I might like to give a talk to the Instituto classes. "Of course," I said. "What do you want me to talk about?" "Oh, whatever takes your fancy, really. We'll leave the subject up to you." Well, addressing the school would, I thought, be pan comido. The Spanish say bread eaten rather than a piece of cake. "You don't have to prepare a thing like this. You just turn up and do it." Or perhaps not. For when I told Chloe, she expressed some concern. "You've got to prepare this speech, Dad," she insisted. "The Instituto class is only a year below me. They're my friends, or at any rate the younger brothers and sisters of my friends." She had a point. This was an important gig, and I had to get it right. So I thought about it for a bit and hit on the theme of laughter and school. "You laugh all your days, but you don't often laugh the way you laughed when you were at school. That gut-busting, aching, joyous agony of laughter. The sort of laughter you have to contain at any cost, for fear that the humourless tyrant doing his level best to illuminate your darkness might suggest that you might want to share the joke with the class." In town, a couple of days before the talk, I put this idea to one of the teachers, Dori, the mother of Chloe's best friend, Maria. It didn't go down too well. She said that although she remembered that laughter from her youth, it was no longer the same. School was a much more serious business today. So I dropped it and wondered what to say instead. Nothing obvious presented itself, and I wondered a little more. And then I had an 11th-hour inspiration. I'd been mulling over the way in which Chloe and her friends, both boys and girls, seemed to treat one another as if they belonged to the same species. Having been to a single-sex boarding school in England, I had for many years harboured a certain envy for boys who went to school with girls, and consequently knew how to deal with them on a more or less equal footing. I decided there and then to address the school on the great benefits of co-education. Now, my method with talks, whatever the language, is to sketch in some basic themes and leave the actual wording of the thing to fend for itself. That way, I imagine, I can achieve an element of spontaneity. So, as I drove along the narrow road to town, I cast my mind back to the momentous day when, after years at that boys' boarding school, I entered Crawley Newtown's finest co-educational sixth-form college. and a giddy, infatuated trance that was to last the best part of 2 years. These were pleasing thoughts to mull upon, but before I knew it, I was being led up the steps of the assembly hall and confronted with a great rabble of youth. There was a not altogether fruitful call to silence. Then the teacher, it was Dorry, introduced me, and I was left alone. I looked out for a moment across the heaving sea of girls and boys, waiting for the muse. And then I was away like a clockwork monkey, relishing the Spanish idioms that sprang to my aid and using my foreignness to advantage. I talked about the advantages of small-town life. I told a little moral tale. I recommended the road less travelled and extolled briefly, and cautiously, some of the virtues of the wild side. And then I launched into my great paean to coeducationalism. I wasn't far into it when a minor linguistic problem presented itself. I was suddenly seized by a doubt that such a word actually existed in Spanish. Why should it? My preferred strategy for this sort of situation is to slide neatly into circumlocution. Forget the grammar and the vocabulary. I just launch myself confidently onto a tangential track. The muse carried me along as I talked in ever more discursive mode about the pleasures of the sexes mingling, the masculine conjoining with the feminine, both coming together to create a well-rounded person. I'm not sure that even I had much of a sense of what this blather was adding up to, and the slightly bemused expression of my audience did little to reassure me. But I plunged heedlessly on with my peroration, ending with my certainty that it was going to school with both girls and boys that had rescued me at the last minute from the warped confines of my earlier single-sex schooling, and that I was sure it would be the making of all of them too. And that, I said, by way of winding up, is that. There was that dread pause, while my local reputation as a speaker hung in the balance. And then, to my relief, a spattering of polite applause, laced with a puzzling undertone of sniggering from the older kids. And Dorry came up on stage, gave me a kiss, and bundled me off. "Phew," I said. "Tough gig." Or rather, I thought I said tough gig. Dorry was looking at me uncertainly. "Un polo duro," is what I said, and that, as I subsequently discovered, does not mean tough gig at all, but rather a hard skittle. However, a hard skittle turned out to be about right when on the following day reports of my speech reached my daughter. She climbed off the bus with an uncharacteristically sour, if not hurt, expression on her face. "Dad, don't you think there are some things that you and Mum might want to discuss with me first before going off and announcing them to the whole of my school?" "To what might you be referring?" I hedged. "To the fact that you're bisexual." This was news to me. "Bisexual? I'm not bisexual. I mean, I've got nothing against bisexuals, but I'm not one. Or at least, not that I'm consciously aware of," I spluttered. "Whatever gave them that idea?" "You did. Apparently that's what you told everyone in your speech yesterday, before urging them to celebrate their own bisexuality. Or at least that's what they reckoned you were saying. Apparently you waffled a lot." "Ah," I said, as the penny began to drop. "I think these poor benighted young people might have got hold of the wrong end of the stick." To add to my mortification, she enlightened me as to the correct word for coeducation. It was coeducación. Who would have thought it?
Last Days of the Bus Club was written and read by Chris Stewart. It's abridged by Pete Nichols, produced by Karen Rose, and it's a Sweet Talk production for BBC Radio 4. Tomorrow, the author is persuaded to put an earth roof on his house, to his neighbour's disbelief. With great pleasure, returns to BBC Radio 4 with the literary choices of Terry Wogan.
I know whichever one of the great man's works I pick, I'll be criticised by my Irish friends for ignoring their favourite, but here goes.
Including W.B. Yeats's poem, When You Are Old.
Take down this book and slowly read and dream of the soft look your eyes had once and of their shadows deep.
Francis Tomalty and David Jason join Terry Wogan in With Great Pleasure on Thursday morning at 11:30.